Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Momentous Podcast. I'm your host, Phil White, and our guest today is Dr. Robert Huggins, Vice President of Research and Athlete Performance and Safety at the Corey Stringer Institute. Robert is one of the world's leading authorities on athlete performance, health, and safety, and uses his experience as an athletic trainer to treat cases of exertional heat stroke at events like the Falmouth Road Race, the Boston Marathon, and the Marine Corps Marathon. We hope you enjoy it as much as we did. So, I guess I could start off by asking you, what do you feel like the data from this particular study implies about performance for warfighters and first responders who may not always have optimal access to fluid replenishment?
Yeah, so that's a really a good question. I think, you know, I know you're aware of the study protocol and everything. Do you want me to go over that first, or?
No, it's okay. No, I have kind of a written summary, I think, that you helped help the team with. So,
sure. So, I think the key findings here are the level of hydration that was maintained over the course of the 5-hour protocol. We found that the group that used the PR lotion showed a significantly less of a body mass loss on the magnitude of 5%, 0.5, sorry, 0.5% body mass loss, less than when they had the control or the placebo lotion. So that means that a person could have, you know, I think it was 250 or 200 milliliters less losses when it comes to using the fluid in tandem with a hyperhydration protocol, which is what we did. So that can have an influence over the course of time, in that if I maintain one's hydration status, that can help to keep blood volume at a higher level, which can then help with sweating, which can then help with cell function, which can then help with cognition, which can also help with thermal regulation, right? So if I have more blood volume and I have a more adequate hydration status, research has shown that this be the case, that people can thermoregulate better for longer, keep their core body temperature lower. And then, you know, I think the other major factor that we found was the cognitive performance changes during the ANAM, where the percent of correct answers during one of the completion of a test called the two-choice test, at the very end of the trial, it was significantly higher, where the PR lotion group had more percent correct than the placebo lotion group. So that was another thing. But on the other, flip the coin, we saw a significant interaction for response time for the go, no go test, but it was the opposite of what we would have thought, in that the PR lotion showed reduced response times or longer compared to the placebo lotion. So there were many other physiological variables that we looked at related to hydration and cardiovascular function, and we did not find any significant differences with many of those variables, based on our study design. I do think that we now have a better idea of the timing of that lotion and how long it takes to absorb, transdermally into systemic circulation. We were getting some individuals who responded more so than others, and we need to look at the factors related to that as to why it is being delivered more more effectively in some individuals than others. And I think the other part is we did not have a trial based on our study design where the person did not have fluid where they just got the lotion by itself. And that is what our next study will be examining, our various doses of the lotion per kilogram body mass, as well as varying hydration status levels.
No, it's good to know. Do you have any thoughts about what we talked about earlier with regard to heat-related events slash injury and the potential for transdermal bicarbonate to act as maybe a prophylactic as opposed to a post-injury or, you know, mid-heat event intervention?
Yeah, so the magnitude of this response was at rest, right? So this is a passive heat exposure. They are not exercising. The next study will include low-grade exercise, which I think will end up elucidating more about the magnitude of the hydration status, the body mass changes that we observed over time could potentially result in lower thermal perception, lower core body temperatures, potentially lower heart rates. But we did not see changes in those variables at rest other than the body mass loss, reduction in body mass loss over the 5 hours. So exercise is a whole different animal, as you probably know. We're not sweating. Essentially, we're sweating lightly, but you're at rest in hot conditions, and now I'm going to have you exercise in those conditions, which can translate to thermoregulatory changes, physiological changes, and then perceptual changes. As I perturb the system more, we might be able to see small differences that we wouldn't otherwise see when someone is sitting passively, as we did with this trial.
Absolutely. Now, 0.5% might seem to the layperson to be an infinitesimal small amount, but what are the ramifications, both physiologically and in terms of cognition, with a loss of 0.5% hydration status?
Can you rephrase that? The second.
Yeah, sure. So, 0.5% might seem like a very small amount in terms of overall hydration, but you mentioned that could have both physical and cognitive effects. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, for just to give some context, there's been research looking at body mass loss and change in body temperature per every 1% that someone loses. And then there's also been research looking at heart rate per every 1% body mass loss in exercising individuals. So if we look at the exercising literature, we know that if you or I show up 1% dehydrated compared to our normal selves who are hydrated and we exercise, for every 1%, you're going to be a half a degree Celsius higher in terms of your body temp, which is about 1 to 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit higher for every 1%. Now, heart rate, you're looking at 5 to 10 beats per minute higher for every 1% that you lose. So cut those values in half, essentially, and you could see slightly higher core temps and slightly higher heart rates as the magnitude of the dehydration becomes greater. It depends in a, warfighter perspective. Opportunities to drink sometimes could be at a minimum. Or maybe they have, bladders that they can take drinks from, or maybe they're very remote and they have no access to fluids. A half a percent can be the difference. The longer they exercise, it can be the difference between, survival or thinking clearly and not. So I think in our most elite warfighters, it matters, just like it does in our most elite of athletes. But the lower you go in terms of risk, in terms of your landscaper, your construction worker, your youth athlete, a half a percent may not mean that much, but if you put it in the context of war and you put it in context of limited access to fluids, it can be a large difference and a large factor later on. You know, I think our goal is always to optimize the whatever we can as often as we can. And hydration is one of those factors. And I think PR lotion showed a significant difference. Is 0.5% a large effect? No, I don't think it's a large effect, because that can easily be replenished with fluids. But if there's no access to fluids and there's 0.5% difference, it could be a large effect. So more research during exercise, which we plan on conducting, will hopefully give us a better understanding. And there's also something to be said about using a product such as this in concert with proper hydration or proper ingestion of electrolytes such as sodium, potassium, and chloride, right? Or proper nutrient timing. I think that when used with other things, although the research hasn't shown this, we haven't tested this yet, I think when used in concert with other things, it may just increase the effect that we might be seeing for some of these variables.
Absolutely. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you didn't see any significant changes in blood sodium, but you did see a at least statistically significant increase in fluid retention. Why do you think that was the case on both sides of that?
So that's a really astute observation and interesting matter. So we anticipated, our hypothesis was that sodium would be delivered to the circulation and that we would see perturbations in individuals' blood sodium levels. The change in the body mass, where is that fluid going then, right? Like, is it staying in the interstitium? Is it within the muscle? Is it getting into circulation? Those were our different variables in the areas in which we think it would go. Based on what we measured, we're unable to determine if it was in the muscle or where it went. But we do know that there were individuals where the sodium levels were perturbed and did increase when they had the lotion, but there were some that it did not. So I'm diving into the variables, the differences between those individuals who it did not respond to. You know, was there a difference in body fat percentage? Was there a difference, did they have hair or no hair? What was the surface area of their upper body relative to others? So there's got to be some other factor that might be at play here. The other thing is our hyperhydration timing occurred after they put the lotion on, and the blood sodium levels, independent of trial, because we were giving such a large bolus of fluid to these individuals, there's a window behind that we were unable to observe what was going on within the blood sodium. So because of the massive volume that we gave, blood sodium has no choice but to go down. It's going to be more dilute. But what we were anticipating, we're seeing differences in the 60, 120, minutes after that fluid retention. And I think we may have given almost too much fluid that we're not able to see what happened to the sodium levels in the blood afterwards. So we're super excited for the next study because we will be able to see those blood sodium levels after the placement of the lotion without any fluid being given. So we'll get a better idea of how much is absorbed with the lotion alone, and then how much is absorbed with the lotion plus some fluid. When you think of the oral sodium ingestion or oral electrolyte ingestion, you have water and electrolytes together, and in the optimal amount, it's going to help to improve your hydration status more so than just water alone. So the sodium that was anticipated being delivered transdermally through the skin plus fluid ingestion, we wanted to optimize the potential for someone to increase their hydration status. It helped for fluid retention over time, but it did not help with changing one's electrolyte levels.
Absolutely. Is it interesting slash exciting to you that we're talking with a supplement like PR lotion about being a bit more proactive rather than reactive to change in hydration status?
Yes. And I think that's one of the most important things as it pertains to heat stroke, as it pertains to cognitive performance under stressful conditions, especially that are exacerbated by the heat, when we have prevention. And anything that can help to gain a subtle edge, anything that can help subtly improve the highest level or the most elite athlete's performance or cognition when it matters the most, should be a positive thing. So I think it's great that we're talking about putting, a cream on an individual that can maybe deliver some sodium and help with fluid retention, which is what ours has shown at rest. I'm really interested to see what happens during exercise, because that's usually when the wheels fall off, essentially, is when we introduce stress via exercise, stress via, bullets shooting at you, what have you, running across a field, or, keeping up with a moving team, or the physical exertion that goes with our most elite forces, or even carrying ammo across a plane. From one end to another, with, 50 cals and all sorts of stuff that people are loading, up in our warships. So, I think those are all ways that we can optimize physical performance. And I think that's why the military is so interested in this, because if there's any edge that our troops can have over our adversaries, I think it's worth doing, right? And investing money in trying to see if novel products such as this can help improve performance.
Absolutely. Given the wider body of work that you and your team do in both hydration and human performance in general there at KSI, what type of impact does a research study like this have on your body of work?
There are many, many products, innovative products that come to us, from hydration wearables to, supplements to cooling technologies to, patches and, various different things that some of them I can't discuss, but many of them are all targeting the same thing. And that is optimizing humans' ability to perform and thermoregulate under hot, stressful conditions. And, when we have products such as this come to us, it's really exciting that we are the first to test these products under conditions in an unbiased fashion, in a triple blinded fashion. We were triple blinded in this study, which, research, that we did a triple blind crossover design with each individual serving as their own control. So they each did both of the two trials, and they had no idea what lotion they were putting on. We had no idea what lotion was putting on. And then after statistical analyses was completed, only then did we unblind ourselves to what the findings were. So we kept the highest level of methodological rigor that we could, but to see if something like this can actually impact is, could be a game changer for many athletes. You think of a Tour de France athlete, you think of a football player, you think of any endurance runner, a trail runner, a warfighter, to be able to apply a lotion that might be able to help you stay more hydrated. And then we're not even talking about the potential effects of bicarb and bicarb's ability to change pH in an advantageous way to allow people to work harder and longer. When you couple being able to work harder, longer, and you're a little more hydrated because of using it, that can be a significant difference between, getting to a checkpoint, getting to the spot before someone else in a game, getting to that loose ball or whatever it is, or just playing safer, being safer, doing what you're doing, in your job, is advantageous for everyone. We track all of the deaths that occur relative to sport at the Corey Stringer Institute. And right now, you know, sad to say, this summer 2021, there's already been quite a few football players and others who have passed due to exertional heat stroke for various reasons. And hydration was probably one of those issues, environmental temperature being probably the predominant issue, and physical fitness being also one of the key players most of the times. You know, and we work very hard to try and change policies in the states relative to high school sports. And we've been very successful in changing those policies for the better. And they include hydration and water breaks. They include, you know, removal of gear. They include removal of weight that someone might be carrying, goalie equipment for field hockey and things of that nature, football players removing their helmets. All of these things are preventative mechanisms to keep people and keep our youngest athletes safe doing what they love, without getting into a heat illness situation. Heat casualties are, you know, very common in the military, especially during training. And it's a fine line, right? Like drill sergeants, coaches, their job is strength conditioning coaches, their job is to push that person to the limit as close as they can to better their performance, but do it in a safe way. And sometimes, even with all the safety mechanisms in place, you still can have a heat illness or a heat stroke. You know, but if we can have products, cooling, hydration related, electrolyte delivery, nutritional, wearables that give us alerts, all of these things can help prevent heat illness when used collectively and keep people safe.
Absolutely. In terms of making those positive changes, whether it be in the military or youth sport or even adult sport, has it partly been confronting that old school kind of no water breaks because that's weak, you know, that kind of mentality as much as anything, and changing culture as much as practice and behavior?
Absolutely. The behavior change is as much a part of this as education, as is the science, as is getting parents, players, coaches to understand that we know the reasons that athletes die in sport. We know them. The top causes are head, heat, heart, and hemoglobin. Hemoglobin having to do with sickle cell trait. But heart, cardiac is the number one cause. Heat is the number two. And in the months of August, heat stroke is number one in the Northeast. So we know how they die, and we know how to treat them, and we know how to what factors need to be present to change them. But oftentimes we are combated against behaviors that you're talking about that are resistant to change because it may not be what they did when they were younger, or, you know, the access to fluids that they had, or that being hydrated is a sign of needing water is a sign of weakness. Every athlete has their own individual needs, especially when it comes to hydration. And if you don't have, you know, a piece of wearable tech that's telling you all that information on that person, you don't know what they're experiencing. You don't know what their heart rates are. You don't know. You can visibly see if someone's struggling, right? But that takes a trained eye. And then you also don't know what was done while they weren't in front of you. How well did they hydrate in the time that they weren't with you, you know? But changing culture is really important. And I think more now than ever, in society, we are placing a higher level on health and safety than we did in the past. And where science is kind of becoming that next performance enhancing substance, if you will, to help our players perform better. And that's the angle we have to take with coaches often. If I start talking health and safety, they often don't really care. They care about wins and losses. And they care about their athletes or their soldiers performing at their best. They do care about the kids' health and safety, but that's not always in the forefront of their mind. Where if I start talking about how it can increase performance in their athletes, and I just use performance synonymous with safety, we can see a lot of change in the mentality of our coaches. And I think we've learned a lot, unfortunately, and this is the wrong way to learn, reactively from cases of sudden death, cases of negligence, cases of where lawsuits have been brought up against the military, against coaches, against other players, parents, things of that nature, where people refrained from giving fluids. They did not follow best practice policies. They ignored the signs and symptoms. They intentionally were punishing someone with a additional workout. Those are all part of what we do in KSI to try and, prevent and educate folks. But I think the tech and the lotion and, the supplements and the proper hydration, the proper sleep. I didn't even mention sleep. Sleep is like such a huge player. And I think the more we educate our youth athletes and our soldiers and our coaches on, how little tweaks that we can implement can change their players' performance or their athletes' safety on the field. The more we educate them, the better and the safer that, they're going to be.
Absolutely. We know you have another project kicking off that's either underway or about to be. Could you tell us a little bit about that without divulging anything confidential?
Sure. So we're going to be examining the PR lotion's effect under a dehydrated state with varying doses of lotion application. And then there will be portions of rest and exercise and similar variables to what we've assessed already will be analyzed, to see if there's any influence of that lotion under more dehydrated stress. And then there will be a couple of sessions that will have some hydration as well to really isolate the effect of the lotion and the hydration. And then if there's a synergistic effect maybe of the hydration plus the lotion as well. So yeah, we're very excited, for that study to see what essentially will come of that. So,
no, for sure. Without blowing too much sunshine at you, you're pretty highly respected and sought after researcher in this field. So why did you decide to take this project on in the first place?
I think, the Corey Stringer Institute has a track record of producing very high quality research that I think many of the companies and the military and, federal funding that we've had, they recognize our level of, our students, of our staff, of our researchers. And I think any time that we can test a product that, could benefit performance or could benefit someone during exercise or could prevent heat illness or optimize hydration, I gladly jump at the ability to do that. Research is not cheap. It is a massive effort, and the control that we have in our laboratories, we have a 440 square foot environmental chamber that goes, from, minus 10 to 110 degrees, and it can get, pretty darn, the humidity can be up to 100% as well. So we have the facilities to be able to test these products under any conditions that those put out the grant, essentially want. But, I love working at the Corey Stringer Institute and seeing the innovation that kind of comes across our desk. Many companies come to us because of what we've been able to do and our abilities from a science perspective, and translating that application, that science to the field and to application, I think is just as important as conducting the research, itself. So it's an honor to work on grants and on projects such as these.
Absolutely. When you were talking about some of those other both kind of reactive and proactive measures, you mentioned wearables. And I know that's an area where, myself, my co-authors, Andy Galpin, who you probably know at Cal State Fullerton, and then Brian McKenzie, look at some of the marketing claims for some of these products, and they're as fantastical or more. And frankly, in some cases, as fictional or more than supplements are, which we know from there being 85,000-86,000 supplements that not everyone's putting in the same level of care and attention as Momentous, to put it mildly, as you know. But with wearables specifically, has the actuality, the reality of what those products can deliver in terms of hydration status and other elements of performance caught up with the promise?
We're getting there. We've tested quite a few wearables. We're in the process of testing many right now, and working with them, with various companies in the product development and beta testing, if you will, phases of some of these products, and or even the end market stage for many of them. To be able to assess hydration status accurately in various individuals is the holy grail if you can do that, because it's going to impact so many different populations and not just athletes. I'm talking, you know, elderly. I'm talking, you know, people who have diabetes. I'm talking people with who are just poor drinkers of fluid and are stressing their bodies more than they realize. You know, there's so many use cases at the workspace, so, you know, any activity level essentially that someone does. If we can be better stewards of our hydration through a wearable, that would be the holy grail in my mind. And if you can add being able to assess core body temperature at the same time with that, I think you're gonna invest in that company. But it's also, the barriers are, is that there's not really right now a lot of uniform requirements for these technological advancements and these applications. And oftentimes we are subjected to the black box, which is their algorithms on the back end, you know, learning us, and the artificial intelligence that might go on with trying to predict whether or not I'm, you know, hydrated that day, or if I, you know, how stressful my exercise might be, or if I'm sick, or if I've just lost a lot of fluids, you know, for various reasons. You know, there's so many dynamic circumstances that technology just isn't there yet, but we have to continue. Our role is to continue to test those devices under the gamut of circumstances that might present. And our area of testing has been sport performance, really, where you see super large perturbations in hydration status, under which we can control those conditions, what people wear, what they are, you know, what they drink, what they eat, within our laboratory space. So wearable tech is getting there, and I hope that someday we are there. That's kind of where we come in, is to help, you know, the consumer understand the research. But when it goes back to your point about claims, is that, you know, the lay person may not be able to read a research article and pull out the important or the significant findings that are within that article, but rather they'd rather just hear from the company as to the claim that they wordsmithed or tweaked to sound good for the public. And I think that's where companies like PR Lotion, who, you know, invest the money in the research and work with quality scientists to understand what they can say and what they can't say, you know, to not have claims that exceed the capabilities of the product. So I think third-party testing is absolutely critical to the success of any good, legitimate product, you know. So too oftentimes things go to market and they're not tested and they're not validated, and people are, you know, confident that that wrist wearable or that thing that they use is doing what it's intended to do, when in actuality it's never even been tested. So we have to be good consumers of media, and we have to be good consumers of products. So, you know, there's a lot of work, I think, that folks could put into the products that they choose to use, more so than what many have done in the past.
Absolutely. You touched on sleep. We just kind of mentioned it in passing. Could you talk about its role in hydration status and overall kind of stress load on the body?
Yeah, so I mean, sleep is just is one of those. It can be a massive recovery aspect to anybody, sport or non, in that your body is constantly undergoing adaptations and responding to the stress and the perturbations that happen to you during that day, whatever it may be. And if you had a strenuous exercise, for example, your body needs that time to recover in order to actually adapt and then supersede or supercompensate based on the stimulus that you just provided in order to advance your training or to get better at something or to simply, maintain your current level of fitness or activity. But sleep can actually cause increases in cortisol. Lack of sleep can cause increases in cortisol, stress hormones, can actually delay thought processes and signaling. There are so many sleep loss and sleep deprivation studies. And we all know that when we don't have a good night's sleep, that we're just not at the same level that we are normally when we are doing our job or cognitively performing or maybe even physically performing when we're on little sleep. Our bodies need that, and they need higher quality sleep over longer quantities of sleep. So, it's really important to get that slow wave sleep. It's really important to get that growth hormone release to be able to repair cells and regenerate at night. And many people don't get that good quality sleep. Even though they get 8 hours, they may not get the good quality that goes through all the stages that they want. And when you have that stress of less sleep, it increases those hormones as I spoke to, and those under really stressful conditions can just add up and lead to a cardiac issue, can lead to a heat issue when you otherwise wouldn't have that. Your core body temperature is slightly higher when you are without a lot of sleep for multiple days, and when it accumulates, when you have cumulative sleep loss over time, it can really impact the way that our body responds to other stressors, such as heat, such as life stress, such as environmental conditions, for example.
That's really fascinating because it's something maybe that connection between sleep, hydration status, and being able to manage all the different types of stimuli that might be bombarding us that again, the layperson may not even consider, or even a higher level competitor.
Yeah, sleep, hydration, which goes along with nutrition and physical fitness, maintaining those things are probably the tenets for an athlete's performance. And then you from that, almost everything else comes back to those items. Sure, there's things we can do to optimize, like heat acclimatization and different lifting strategies, and there's a lot of things that we can improve one's performance and training. But if you don't recover appropriately by giving our body the fuel it needs, the fluid it needs, and the rest that it needs, and maybe even the attention from a massage and various other recovery modalities that can assist our bodies, or even wearables, which can be used as a recovery tool. If you know that you're stressed when your watch is telling you that, but you don't think you are, that can be a behavior change, which can cause someone to improve their sleep or to eliminate distractions in their day-to-day life, or reduce stress, meditate, yoga, all different things that might be positive for that individual to stress is stress is stress. There was a stressful environments class that I took years ago, taught by the infamous Dr. Larry Armstrong. It was called Stressful Environments. And the first slide of the class was stress is stress is stress in the whole class. And we were like, what the heck is he talking about? And then when you start getting into it, you really understand that stress is the center, the epicenter of how our body recovers. And that perturbation of all the different stressors that we place our body under, we are constantly adapting to. And it's how we adapt and the things that we do to optimize or minimize that stressor that will be the difference between performing well and not.
Great. If you have time for one last question, what is it about your role that either gets you up early in the morning or keeps you up late at night, or sometimes all of the above?
Well, the day-to-day and the logistics of working with human subjects is the part that keeps me up at night. And managing, you know, many, many moving parts and controlling the uncontrollables sometimes are the difficult parts. The things that get me up are the fact that my work or our work at the Corey Stringer Institute can, you know, go from making someone think better on a test or on a task during the day to getting a gold medal at the Tokyo Olympics, like or you know, go to the warfighter scenario between, you know, hitting that shot and not hitting that shot, between making a good decision and making a decision that you regret for the rest of your life. You know, our work can impact so many soldiers, laborers, athletes, lay people. And I just think the human body gets me up every day because I would love to adapt or help the human body be better at what it already does so well. And I think science is kind of leading the way now, especially in sport. I call it the art and science of sport. Yes, you have to be good and understand the art of that sport, but you also need to understand your body and how your body is reacting to that sport. It can be as good of a tool as knowing every play in the playbook, you know, or understanding military strategy or systems. You know, you need to be able to do that. So for me, the grad students also that I work with are some of the top in the country. And to work with them and to keep up with them keeps me going, keeps me happy. And my passion for them and for science is what gets me up.
Well, fantastic. We've been very generous with your time and insight. Thank you so much.